Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ken Mayer. I'm at Fenway Health in Boston and Harvard Medical School. I'm delighted to be moderating this debate today with our protagonist, Dr. Sten Vermund, who is the head of global health and a professor at Vanderbilt University, has been involved in HIV and STD prevention research for many years, including directing the HIV Prevention Trials Network. And his worthy antagonist is Dr. Jean Marazzo, who's professor of medicine in the infectious disease division at the University of Washington in Seattle, has been director of STD Prevention Training Center for many years, as you're well aware, and leader in the ASTDA, and another person who has really spent a lot of time thinking about both HIV and STDs. The format for this debate, the premise is that HIV prevention does not need to include STD prevention. So actually taking the pro side will be Dr. Vermund, saying that prevention does not need to include STD prevention. Dr. Marazzo will be discussing why HIV prevention does need to include STD prevention. So before we start, we'd like to take a sense of the audience. So for all those who would vote with the pro position that HIV prevention does not need to include STD prevention, please raise your hands. Okay. And those who are opposed to the motion. Okay. Okay. So we can see this is going to be a very evenly divided debate. So we have to do the debate. And each of our speakers will have 7 minutes to make their opening comments. They will then each have 3 minutes to rebut each other, and then you and the audience will have at them, and we will vote again at the end. So our first speaker, our pro speaker, Dr. Vermund.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I fully expected to, how do you change the slide? Here we go. I fully expected to have the vote be about 200-1 against me, and your program is wrong. Now, why I submit the documentation to say that I work at Vanderbilt University and then I get affiliated with Johns Hopkins University is a mystery, but I'm at Vanderbilt. Now, everybody knows that STDs increase the risk of HIV acquisition. The data on this are overwhelming. So this means that somebody on the organizing committee does not like me. I'm assigned to the opposition to STD prevention in the context of this meeting. I mean, this meeting, everybody believes in STD prevention. I'm assigned to argue against it. Plus, I'm debating the dazzling and charismatic Jeannie Marazzo, much beloved, and I'm in big trouble. I'm in big trouble. But the next 6 minutes are going to show you why I'm right and she's wrong. The data do not lie. One lonely trial published in 1995, the Mwanza study, says you can reduce HIV incidence with syndromic management of STDs. All subsequent trials, 9 subsequent trials, have shown no impact of a variety of STD control strategies on HIV acquisition transmission. Hence, we in this room have a conundrum. STDs are important to control for their own sake, obviously. But the data tell us not to expect an impact on HIV transmission from STD control in a hyperendemic region like Africa. And I could also argue, if I had more time, the case that key populations like female sex workers, men who have sex with men, also not strongly impacted by STD control. The Mwanza study was not, in fact, generalizable. It was reflecting a moment in time of rising HIV in which heterosexuals with the highest risk of STDs were also the ones most likely to transmit HIV, the so-called core transmitter group. Now, in Africa, the risk is generalized far beyond core STD risk groups, and the most commonly transmitted STD is actually HIV. So if you control STDs, the majority of people transmitting STDs, transmitting HIV, don't have STDs. So this is the key question. Why are STDs a risk factor for HIV, but their control does not result in a decline in HIV incidence? Answer number one, I postulate STDs are not the principal cause of the inflammatory milieu of the abnormal vaginal microbiome. They're just not. They contribute. Chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, trichomonas, they contribute. But look at all the other things that contribute. Candidiasis, bacterial vaginosis, urinary schistosomiasis, douching, vaginal drying agents, overuse of antibiotics. STD control doesn't do anything for all of those items that I've colored in yellow. The result is that a highly alkaline, highly abnormal vaginal microbiome is not producing the natural protections that the hydrogen peroxide-producing lactobacilli offer. And you can treat STDs hither, thither, and yon, but unless you actually restore a normal vaginal milieu, you're not going to get anywhere. Answer number two, the interventions for STDs are simply not robust. Suppressive HSV2 therapy didn't actually suppress. Antibiotics do not protect against reinfection with near absent partner notification programs in low and middle income countries. BV and Candida therapies are imperfect with high recurrence. Probiotics have a very spotty track record. They're difficult, they're costly, they're not available. STD vaccines are not available, with one exception, hepatitis B. The result there is that STD investments have low to no HIV impact. The solution? Alternative investments are more promising. So, if you want to control STDs and adverse pregnancy outcomes, invest in STD control programs. I'm voting with all of you. But to control HIV, focus on evidence-based prevention successes that reduce HIV incidence. Male circumcision, proven. Home-based testing and linkage to care, absolutely necessary for anything else to work. Treatment as prevention, including PMTCT, needle and syringe exchange. These things work. We need combinations of these things to maximize our impact on the epidemic. The evidence-based add STD control at high cost, not going to impact HIV. Good thing to do. In its own right, not going to impact HIV. Overwhelming evidence that STD investments as currently formulated will not succeed in reducing HIV incidence. We have a research challenge here, folks, not the time to be implementing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Vermond. And now Dr. Marazzo.
Oh, Sten. It's a measure of your desperation that you felt compelled to harness my considerable vaginal energy and microbiome data to make your argument. So I'll just put that out there. I mean, really. Okay. So here's my premise. Genital HIV viral load is a major predictor of transmission. STI is common in persons with HIV, and STIs increase the genital viral load. And in those at risk for HIV, very important, incident STIs among men who have sex with men strongly predict subsequent HIV acquisition. Many, most STIs are asymptomatic, don't prompt care seeking, yet they still cause, quote unquote, subclinical inflammation. Thus, you really have to screen to detect them, right? We know that accurate detection and effective treatment of STIs in HIV-infected people renders these people less infectious for HIV. It lowers their genital viral load. And in HIV-uninfected person, it makes them less susceptible to HIV. ART for prevention is a very worthy goal. That's where I assume that my opponent wants to put the resources that he's taking away from STD control into. But it does not address the effect of superimposed STDs on genital HIV viral load. More successful ART improves well-being with attendant effects on sexual health. People feel better, they have more sex, they have more vigorous sex, and they have more pleasure, which is good, but sadly, they get more STDs. And clearly, there's a reduced perception, I think, of HIV infectiousness if you're on suppressive ART. So to control STD, I believe, is to reduce transmission of HIV. So let's just take a look at a little bit of the evidence. This is a study, I think, that does not get much play, but was incredibly important, and this relates to the genital viral load of HIV as it pertains to transmission. This is a beautiful study by Jared Baton, who you heard from yesterday, incidentally, one of the debaters, looking at 2,500 serodiscordant couples and following the infected partner's genital HIV over time, and then relating this, just as Tom Quinn did in his famous New England Journal paper, to the likelihood of transmission over time. And what you're seeing here for both men and women is this beautiful curve of the likelihood of HIV, the number of events by the plasma viral load, so the genital viral load. Why aren't we owning this in STDs? The HIV people could care less about this. We should really be focusing on this as a priority for our field. We're the only ones who care about what's going on down there. Okay? I'm going to skip that. That was just to say that there's a lot of these diseases. Now, and then this flip side about what about HIV acquisition? Beautiful work by the New York City Health Department and some other studies that have shown that incident STDs strongly predict subsequent HIV in U.S. MSM. This is just one study that showed rectal infection associated with significant increase in likelihood of subsequent HIV. Really very impressive. For example, among those who tested chlamydia and gonorrhea negative, incidence of HIV, if you were diagnosed with syphilis over the course of, I believe, 2 to 3 years, was 8.3 versus 1.9. So really remarkable. The CAPRISA 004 trial in South Africa looked at a similar question, and they studied young women at very high risk of HIV. And I would just draw your attention to, I guess you guys can't really see that, so I'm going to burn somebody's eye out down there. But basically look at the hazard ratio in the adjusted analysis for gonorrhea. Women who had gonorrhea during the study precedent before their HIV was detected had a fivefold likelihood of increased risk of HIV. There's no question that these infections are having a major issue in this area. And then a beautiful study. If you haven't read this, I highly recommend you take a look at it. This was also the serodiscordant couple study in Africa. James Hughes published this in JID just this year, looking at determinants of per-coil act HIV infectivity among the serodiscordant couples. And what did they find? That basically if people had HSV2 seropositivity, they had genital ulcer disease by exam or self-report during follow-up, they had trichomonas vaginalis in enrollment, or cervicitis or vaginitis during follow-up, they were all significantly likely to increase their per-act likelihood of transmission. This is not a cumulative thing. This is a great prospective study that really shows this premise. We know that STIs cause inflammation and that that's related to genital HIV shedding. I'm just showing you a few of these millions of papers that support my premise. So, what are we talking about here, and what might we do to act on these things? So the consensus, I think, is that attributable risk of STIs in promoting HIV transition is substantial, and even Sten agreed, even my opponent agreed that these matter. So we're thinking about genital alterations, inflammatory STDs, hormonal contraception, and the other things there. The question is, can STI prevention really modify these risks, whether it's primary or secondary prevention? Now, you've already heard the evidence was rather dismissed. The question is, does interventions that control STI, do they decrease genital viral load? And I believe that they do. The evidence is not as robust as I would like, but it's very good for some inflammatory STDs, particularly trichomoniasis in men and women. Do STI interventions decrease plasma viral load? Yes, some of them indeed do. The evidence, I would say, is best for HSV2 treatment with valacyclovir, which is better than acyclovir. And there is some evidence, too, for early syphilis that Jeff Klausner and his colleagues in San Francisco have published. Is there an observed effect on the risk of HIV transmission? It is not robust, but I would say that there's very limited evidence that relates to multi-component intervention. And nobody would go in there and say, let's just test for syphilis and not talk about anything else. STIs need to be part of a multi-component intervention aimed at enhancing the care and the life of HIV-infected people and people at risk for HIV. What about decreasing susceptibility in the genital tract? I think that it was already mentioned that, indeed, we don't have great tools to do what we would like to do here. We can suppress herpes shedding. This is just a study published by Christine Johnson in Lancet last year showing that, indeed, it didn't matter whether people were put, if they were HSV2 seropositive, on standard dose valacyclovir, high dose valacyclovir, or standard dose acyclovir. They still shed. So we really don't have the tools. That's not to say if we had the tools, we couldn't affect some change here. Okay? So in general, this is how I would leave you thinking in this first phase of this debate. Genital HIV viral load is a major predictor of transmission? Absolutely. STIs are common in persons with or at risk for HIV acquisition and increased genital viral load in HIV persons? Yes. I think sometimes, maybe not always, but it depends. Many, most STIs are asymptomatic, yet they still cause subclinical inflammation. They require screening? Absolutely. accurate detection and effective treatment of STIs in HIV-infected renders them less infectious for HIV, I think, sometimes. Accurate detection and treatment renders them less susceptible sometimes. So the bottom line is that we will not figure this out or make an impact until we implement multi-component STD control and develop more precise methods for measuring impact. Let's do it.
Thank you, Dr. Marazzo. And now Dr. Vermont has 3 minutes to rebut.
Dr. Marazzo, I speak to you directly. Thank you for your principled stand defending a point of view that 99% of the people in this room already agreed with. I think that really takes courage, that really takes guts. What I'd like to say is that the 2 points that I made, that STDs are only a tiny fraction of the disruption of the integrity of the vaginal milieu, and that we do not yet know in an efficient, effective way how to restore the protections, the natural protections in the vagina, that is a research agenda. And until we get a handle on this, it's a fool's errand to simply treat a few STDs and think you're going to transform the environment. The second point I'd like to make is the one that I already made, which is that the strategies to control STDs have not worked to prevent HIV. Therefore, we need better strategies. 9 out of 10 trials didn't work. Ironically, the very first trial worked. We got very excited about that. And we made substantial investments in STD control as a direct consequence. We don't see any ecological evidence of an impact of those investments. And frankly, 9 subsequent negative studies have thrown a damper on this. I'm a big supporter of research in this area. I would love for a strategy, multi-component approach, to actually work to prevent HIV. I would love to see that. Haven't seen it. Don't think we can make the argument to the policymakers that you should divert money from whatever, say HIV treatment, into STD control programs, because STD control programs are going to work better than treatment as prevention, going to work better than male circumcision, going to work better than home-based testing and linkage to care, going to work better than needle exchange, as sterile needle use, going to work better than PMPCT. Those are evidence-based. We can make those investments. They're going to work. STD control, we're still in the research arena. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Vermont. Dr. Marazzo.
Dr. Vermont, let me speak to you directly.
I was afraid of that.
I will not be intimidated by your stentorian voice and your solar back status. I just want to say, okay? And in fact, I will actually show some slides that I prepared for the rebuttal, okay? Okay, so I'm fully aware of the evidence that you cite, and in fact, there was a very nice discussion in this paper, so what would I say about it? Well, there is clearly a lack of high-level evidence, right, to demonstrate the impact of STDI prevention. I think we can agree on that. We can agree on that. But obviously, the clinical trials were not optimally designed for real-world prevention. I think we're both talking about the same thing. They really need to target the right STD at the right time in the right population, and that is an incredibly difficult target for an affordable and realistic randomized controlled trial. It's setting the bar incredibly high. We need to use the most effective drug or drugs. Syndromic treatment stinks. We all know that. It really is just dark ages for management. We shouldn't be doing it. It's a really, really big problem. Endpoint determination is really tough. The timing of STDs relative to HIV acquisition is really imprecise. I mean, we don't even know half the time when people got either of these infections, yet we're attempting to link the intervention to the outcome. And then we really, really need to include partner management. Individual focus, I think, is very likely to have a limited impact at community levels with high rates of reinfection unless we include aggressive partner management strategies in these efforts. And then finally, I just say something that's been pointed out is that all the studies we're talking about have derived attributable risk from people who acquired HIV. The effect of the intervention in those who remain negative may be underestimated. It's a really important, I think, epidemiologic principle. And then finally, the criticism that the effect of the genital and plasma viral load infectivity is inconsistent when you look at STD control, the comments about the vaginal milieu notwithstanding, we know that different STDs likely have different dynamic measures, effects on these measures, and genital viral load in particular probably fluctuates pretty rapidly. It's hard to monitor this frequently. It's hard to measure it with the assays that we have. And look, I actually put this in even before I knew what you were going to say. Co-infection with STDs, specifically HSV2 and dysbiosis, which is now, by the way, my preferred term for the conditions that we're talking about. It's a little bit au courant in the microbiome world. You might want to consider maybe critical background and not always considered. Thank you, Ina Park, for that slide.